Welcome back to JFK Spotlight on Health, where we highlight the groundbreaking work being done at JFK University Medical Center in Edison, part of the Hackensack Meridian Health Network. Back once again, not really an encore presentation, the return of Dr. Thomas Steinecke, Vice Chair, Department of Neuroscience and JFK Neuroscience Institute, and Chair of the Neurosurgery Hackensack Meridian Health Central Region. Welcome back.
Oh, thanks, Joel. It's great to be back.
There was a great deal of information that we just didn't have time to get to last time, so we thought, let's do it again. Let's do a part two.
Absolutely. So there's plenty to talk about.
Yeah, we'll call it Dr. Steinecke, the sequel.
There you go.
So let's jump into it. For about 25 years now, you've had a pediatric neurosurgery department there, neuroscience pediatric, and maybe some people weren't aware of that, so tell us about that.
Yes, sir. So our original founder, Russ Zappula, had a passion for pediatrics. So when he developed the Institute approximately 30 years ago, he recruited in a pediatric intensive care unit specialist, a neurosurgeon, pediatric neurologist, everything that really makes a strong pediatric neuroscience program to really, you know, complement the adult program. So all the complexities that we treat in the adult side, we also treat on the pediatric side. It may not be as well known, given that that JFK is not a children's hospital. However, this particular program is really a tertiary program at the level that you'd find at any children's hospital. For instance, we treat patients with brain tumors, kind of all shapes and sizes of brain tumors, and we benefit from being part of a strong neuroscience program in general, because the technologies that we use in the adult world, we can also modify and use in the pediatric world. So, for instance, when I'm talking to a patient, and generally their parents, and explaining a particular operation for a brain tumor, I can use our advanced virtual reality and augmented reality technology, put it in a virtual world, and quite literally show the patient and the parents the brain tumor, why it's a problem, and what are the solutions. So that really brings it to life for the patient's family, and really it gives them a level of comfort. It makes something that's very kind of obscure and theoretical and something that they can see, and they can see the solution for it. Not only with brain tumors, but we also treat pediatric conditions. For instance, Chiari malformation, which is a malformation in the back of the brain, and that often needs a decompression and operation to repair the malformation. We treat children with hydrocephalus, tethered cord, all the different aspects of neurological disease in children. My colleagues and pediatric neurologists, they see some of the most complex epilepsy cases, patients with seizures. Seizures are one of the more common conditions in children, and really good need a expert in the treatment of the seizures to control the seizures. And at a certain point, if we can't control those seizures and medications, there are surgical options that often will render these patients seizure-free and able to live a normal life. We also see patients with autism and behavioral disorders, and also one of the more common conditions is headaches and concussion. So we have the whole gamut of care for these patients with pediatric patients, children with neurological disease, that you may not think about when you look at JFK, because it's not a big children's hospital. Mm-hmm. But we've, over the last 25 years, we've had a concerted effort to truly build a program that's equal to any of the big programs at the Children's Hospital, and really gives a very personalized care for these patients.
Yeah, and people are coming from all over the state to see you. But when they come in, I mean, this is scary for, obviously, parents. Of course, the children as well. But when they come in, and you can actually, when you touched on this earlier, actually we touched on it last time a little bit about the virtual reality, how you can look at the patient's, in this case, the child's brain, and show it to the child or the parents. What kind of reaction do you get from that when you when they can actually see their child's brain?
It's kind of funny. There's a big spectrum. Most of the time, there's an aha moment. Because you're really taking it to the theoretical. Somebody, you know, their pediatricians contact them and say, hey, you need to go see Dr. Steinecke, or you need to go to the emergency department because you have a brain tumor. And so that's, you know, they generally get the worst case scenario image in their mind. And sometimes, a lot of times in the pediatric population, these tumors are benign. About half of the brain tumors we see are low-grade or benign tumors. And so by speaking with them and showing them in the virtual reality, we show them exactly where it is, and then we can kind of talk through them, okay, what's the next steps in the treatment? If it's surgery, we can literally show them how we do the surgery through a virtual reality. So it really puts their mind at ease, and it really makes something that's kind of big and scary and makes it a little more real and a little bit more able to get their hands around and to deal with, frankly. And that's probably 80 to 90% of the reactions. And so, but, you know, on the flip side, sometimes it's a little bit too real. And so as a pediatric practitioner, the pediatric practitioners are pretty adept at reading the patient's parents and the patient and knowing how to present things in a manner in which, you know, it's going to reach them and connect with them. Generally the kids and the teenagers are generally really into it, and it's almost like a video game for them to look at. But that's, you know, that's how they deal with it. Mm-hmm. They say, hey, it's a video game, and it becomes a little bit more real, but also becomes a little less scary once they see it and they see the virtual reality. So I think it, by and large, puts the parents' mind at ease, and then at least in the teenage population, it helps them connect in and gives them a frame of reference as well, and a little bit more control of what's going on in their body, frankly.
So you're able to show them what the issue is, but not only that, you're going to show them how you're going to resolve the issue.
Oh, absolutely. And that's the power of it, because it's not only shows them the, and you have to remember, even the state-of-the-art imaging is 2D. And so when you're looking at an MRI scan, it's in two dimensions. So it's basically a big white spot, and you say, hey, that big white spot's a problem. And that generally doesn't connect with non-medical people. And that's, frankly, most of us are non-medical people. But when you put it in the 3D VR, it actually looks like a tumor. There's a mass there, and you can see how it's pushing on the brain. And then we can show them, okay, we need to do an opening here in the skull in order to get to that tumor, and this is how we remove it. And we can actually simulate how we're going to remove it. So it gives them knowledge and it gives them a very practical image. And so it just makes it less scary and more able for them to deal and wrap their minds around it, so to speak.
Are tumors the most common neurosurgical condition in children? I know you mentioned that seizures were most common, but something has to be causing a seizure.
Yeah. Yeah, there's tumors are very common in the pediatric population. Behind leukemias, they're the second most common type of neoplasm, frankly. And so they are fairly common. With seizures, and they do often cause seizures, but they only cause probably a fraction of the majority of seizures. The majority of seizures are, they don't have an underlying structural issue. There's probably some abnormal electrical connections that are making the brain more irritable than it should be. And that's the most common cause of seizures. Mm-hmm. But certainly a brain tumors are a subset of that. And especially if a child presents with a seizure, if there's any question about about the neurological exams, there's any like headaches prior to it or any weakness or any type of red flags, then those kids really should be scanned. And it is pretty common that we'll find an underlying lesion in those situations. Mm-hmm. For the neurosurgeon, actually hydrocephalus is probably the most common condition that we treat. And hydrocephalus is commonly referred to as the water on the brain. So that's, for a neurosurgeon, that's the most common thing that we do. And the virtual reality is great for that as well, because we can literally show the it's not a theoretical discussion of, hey, your child has too much water inside the brain, but we can literally show them the ventricles, which are the fluid-filled spaces inside the brain, show them how dilated they are and compare them to what we would expect. And then we can also show them the operation that we use in order to treat that condition. And we, for children with hydrocephalus, we use advanced techniques for treatment. We often can put in an endoscope, which is a little camera on the end of a tube, so it's minimally invasive, and then recreate the channel that the fluid should be flowing through to treat the hydrocephalus, so we don't have to put in a shunt. And a shunt is literally kind of, it's literally plumbing. It's a tube that goes inside the brain. It's connected to another series of tubes that goes under the skin and drains the fluid into the belly. And that's the more traditional way of treating the hydrocephalus. But for the neurosurgeon, that's the most common condition that we treat.
That's amazing. So you're running a tube, or plumbing, as you called it, that wasn't there before, from the brain down to the stomach?
That's correct. And that is actually a tried and true treatment for the hydrocephalus. And on the just the sheer number of cases, it's one of the most common procedures that we do, frankly, especially in the pediatric population.
How small is that tube?
Well, the tube's maybe an eighth of an inch in diameter or so. It's pretty small. And most of the time, you don't see it underneath the skin. Mm-hmm. You might see a little bump as it runs across the clavicle as it's going down, or the collarbone as it's going down to the belly. But most of the time, the hardware is underneath the scalp, and the hair covers it. So you see people all the time that have treated hydrocephalus. You never know it, because you can't tell by just looking at them, as the shunt systems are pretty well hid by the scalp and the hair, and then just the tissues as they go down to the belly.
You're correct. You would never know, because I never heard of this. This is amazing.
Sure. And for the treatment of hydrocephalus, within the last 10 to probably 15 years, it's becoming, the endoscopic treatment is becoming more popular, because you simply don't have the hardware. And so if you can open up the correct channels, it's called an endoscopic third ventriculostomy, the technical term for it. But if you can open up the channel and bypass the blockage and get the fluid where it needs to be so it gets absorbed in the brain, that's generally my first approach. If I can do the endoscopic third ventriculostomy, or do a procedure where I can put the endoscope in and open up the connections, that's my first choice, because then you don't have the hardware. Because anytime you have hardware, there's a chance that it fails.
Right.
So any type of plumbing has a certain percentage that it will fail. And so I usually will try the endoscopic or more advanced minimally invasive procedures first, and then some patients just don't respond to that, and you do have to put the shunt in or the hardware in.
Yeah, you said that, you mentioned, that was my next question about it failing. Does this last a lifetime? I guess depending on how old the patient is. But if we're talking about children,
sure.
The plumbing, does that have to be replaced over a certain amount of years?
Yeah, a fair number do. Probably over the lifetime of a shunt, with probably about 50% will need to be replaced. And especially when we put it in infants, because one of the common neurological conditions in infants is hydrocephalus. So in those patients, we'll put a shunt in, and often the catheter that goes inside the brain needs to be replaced, because they simply outgrow it. We generally put enough catheter inside the belly, so it will be long enough even in, once they're adults. But often they go through probably at least one revision between, during growing up. there are certain segments actually that have a lot more issues with shunts. Some people seem to have almost an inflammatory response to shunts, and so they will go through multiple failures. Mm. So shunts, the hydrocephalus, it can be a troublesome problem. And fortunately for the vast majority, one or two procedures, and they do very well. But for a small subset, it can be a rather troublesome problem to deal with.
Okay, one more quick question, then we'll move on. When it comes to this surgery, after it's done, are there any restrictions?
By and large, no. I know that some surgeons will actually restrict patients from any type of contact sports,
mm-hmm,
or
right.
From sports. I generally don't, simply because over my 20 years experience, I can think of maybe a couple cases in which a patient was hit in the head just in the right area to affect the shunt. And so it's exceptionally rare that the shunt gets manipulated by any type of external contact. So in my practice, I generally, after a patient's out of the immediate postoperative period, I generally let them go back to normal activities. So if they do well from their hydrocephalus, if there's no other underlying issues, then these patients overall live very, very healthy, active lives.
Well, that's good news, because we're talking about children. And of course, children want to be active. They want to play sports. So to tell them that they can't do it anymore would be very disappointing.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so.
That's a tough conversation for, you know, certain patients I've had to tell that they couldn't go back to their sports.
Oh.
There's a condition called the arachnoid cyst, which is a big kind of fluid area that forms inside the brain. And although often it doesn't need surgery, it does make patients more prone for head injury and for developing bleeds within the cyst. And so I've had some pretty tough conversations with patients' parents and patients with regards to sports, because, you know, sports is a very, very important part of a lot of children's growing up and their development. And I really don't like to restrict that part of their lives, but sometimes in the contact sports, you just have to.
Dr. Thomas Steineke, Vice Chair, Department of Neuroscience and JFK Neuroscience Institute, and the Chair of Neurosurgery at Hackensack Meridian Health Central Region, talking about pediatric neurosurgery. But let's talk about the comprehensive brain tumor program that you have there at the JFK Neuroscience Institute.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So with Dr. Zappula coming in and developing an institute 30 years ago, one of his crowning jewels, so to speak, was the development of a comprehensive brain tumor program. And we've had essentially almost on a weekly basis a meeting of the brain tumor conference, literally for the last 25 to 30 years, in which experts from neurosurgery and neurology and neuro-oncology and radiology and all come together and talk about patients with brain tumors. I do skull-based tumors, which are a common tumor called a meningioma, and acoustic neuromas, and anything that affects the skull base. I have one of my partners that focuses on the more malignant type of brain tumors, the GBMs and intrinsic tumors. And so we have an entire gamut of treatments for these patients, including surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, and some more advanced, or they're all advanced treatments, but we also have treatments for patients who are not necessarily able to undergo surgery. There's a laser type of treatment that we can literally treat a patient with a laser therapy by putting in a little probe, and then the laser heat treats the tumor. So it's a minimally invasive approach to tumors we wouldn't otherwise be able to operate on. But our program's unique in that it's not a lot of health systems have all the pieces, but they're not in one place. We literally have all the pieces. We're meeting on a weekly basis. So the communication about patients, the development of patient plans is seamless. And so we've been doing it over 25 years. And also we're cutting edge in our technology. The AR and VR program is something that is highly beneficial for the treatment of tumors, not only patient engagement and education, but also operative planning and making our approaches as minimally invasive as possible, yet still getting the job done. The advanced technologies in the operating room with our microscopes and our navigation. So we're second to none with the technology we use to treat these patients on the surgical level. My colleague, Dr. Joseph Landolfi, is a preeminent neuro-oncologist and has been doing this for the last 25 years himself, mm-hmm. and is really has a connection with all the up-to-date chemotherapies and treatments for these brain tumors, including the genetic analysis. Because over the last few years, we've really gone to genetically analyzing all these tumors and really developing a personalized plan for these different brain tumors.
Well, and in talking about the AR and VR, when you diagnose a brain tumor, are you able to see, look at that and see what type of tumor? I mean, there's several different types, correct?
Sure. Yeah. With the imaging, it gives us the VR and AR certainly reconstructed into a 3D world, and that definitely helps us try to distinguish, because this is a meningioma, which is a type of benign tumor that's close to the surface of the brain. Is it more of a GBM? So it can certainly help, and it's most beneficial, of course, when we're educating patients, but that certainly helps in the evaluation process, trying to distinguish how the tumor itself relates to the brain. And different tumors will relate to the brain or will affect the brain a little differently. So certainly helps and augments the current imaging information that we get from the current imaging.
So let's talk about, very briefly, in the few minutes we have left, about migraines, because a lot of our listeners, a lot of people have issues with migraines. How do you treat it?
The treatment of migraines has really evolved over the last decade or so. It used to be a handful of medications, like the Imitrex was the classic one, and there was not a lot more we could do for patients back maybe 10 years ago. We have a couple of experts, Dr. Brian Gerhardstein and Dr. Ahmad Noor, who are our headache specialists, and they're really at the cutting edge of treatments for migraines. And generally what how this occurs is a patient is having trouble with severe headaches. And it affects maybe a third of our population have frequent significant headaches. So it's a big health issue. So within neuroscience, we have a comprehensive plan. They come in, have an evaluation with Dr. Gerhardstein or Noor, and who are certified headache neurologists. And you first start looking at the different triggers and different health factors or environmental factors that could be contributing. You know, is somebody, you know, is it around the cycle for a woman? Is it a, you know, every time they eat chocolate, every time they drink red wine? Or there's a bunch of environmental triggers. So they look at that. So they take a very holistic approach to the treatment of these headaches. And then they start looking at it. And a lot of patients will chronically use over-the-counter medications. And sometimes that can actually make the problem worse. Often they will look at their medication use and say, hey, let's wean you off this. Let's look at your triggers. Let's decrease your triggers. And also just different health practices, relaxation and treating anxiety helps with headaches as well. So they look at a holistic approach, wean off some of the medications that may actually be contributing. And then if need to, they start adding in some more of the modern headache medications. Usually we'll start with a medication that's taken on a daily basis, and it's more of what we call a prophylactic medication or try to prevent the migraines. And then they usually will add in a rescue medication. So when you get a migraine, this is what you do. And there are so many headache medications now that they really kind of tailor the medication regimen to the patient. And the vast majority of the time, patients find relief with adjusting their medications, getting them the right combination. but for a small percentage, they just can't get them handled. So they actually will bring them in the hospital and use IV medications, a cocktail of IV medications, to really break the cycle and get patients feeling more comfortable, and then start adding in some prophylactic medications. So it's a very holistic, comprehensive approach. And I'm proud of the work that Dr. Gerhard Stein and Noor are doing for us within the Neuroscience Institute here. And we're actually developing a fellowship program, and it's called a headache fellowship, in which we will be training neurologists how to better take care of headaches.
Dr. Thomas Steinecke, we are out of time, but thank you so much once again for joining us here on the program.
I greatly appreciate it, Joel. It's been a sheer pleasure. Have a great day.
If you'd like more information, go to jfkmc.org. If you'd like a podcast of the show, go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com. JFK Spotlight on Health, it's brought to you by Hackensack Meridian Health. Keep getting better. I'm Joel Katz, and we'll talk to you next week.